Alamut by Vladimir Bartol is the best-selling Slovenian novel of all time in its home country. It tells the story of Hasan ibn al-Sabah, the fabled Ismaili controller of the fortress Alamut and the leader of an army of fiercely loyal fanatical killers. Translated editions have become top sellers all across Europe since its publication in 1938, and yet it has only been available in English since 2004. In our first underappreciated segment of the summer, translator Michael Biggins, also the head of the Slavic and East European section of the University of Washington Libraries, and Tjasa Kopovic, an editor at Sanya House, which publishes the Slovenian edition of the novel, join me to talk about the author's life and work. Welcome to our show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Good afternoon.
Alamut is one of the most beloved works of Slovenian literature, but it's not even about Slovenia. Why is it so popular, Tjasa?
Well, this novel brings charismatic and complex characters, I suppose, being a timeless political allegory imbued with elements of romance and political intrigue. It proves its importance also as a book about political and historical considerations of fanaticism. And it also reads as an encyclopedia of philosophy, psychoanalysis, politics, and I suppose scientific ideas.
That's because the author was not only interested in Freudian and Jungian psychology, but also in the ideas of Nietzsche.
In the ideas of
Friedrich Nietzsche.
Nietzsche, yes, true. Well. What is interesting, and not many people know that, well, some do, he was an educated introspective psychologist who acted on instinct to be finally transmitted 50 years onward and 50 years backwards, as Bartol himself put it. He believed it to be, as he referred to it, a function that acted automatically. He even kept a record of such instinctive shifts. I believe that it took time of no less than 20 years for somewhat brutal struggle with the matter named Alamut to end. The mentioned struggle mainly began when he was a young boy. So,
let's get Michael in here. Michael, didn't Bartol translate Nietzsche into Slovenian for the first time? And I think that's interesting because Nietzsche also wrote a famous book about an ancient Persian, thus spoke Zarathustra.
That's true. Nietzsche functioned for Bartol, I think, mainly as inspiration for a collection of short stories that he published in the late 1920s and early 1930s. That collection eventually came out under the title Al-Araf, which is the wall in that divides hell from paradise, in Islamic theology. But his characters had very little to do with Islam in that short story collection. They were mostly character studies with a strong element of Nietzscheanism. He was looking at characters who were experimenting with Nietzscheanism themselves in maybe an extreme form, and he was casting a very critical eye on most of them.
But how does he even become interested in Islam? He grows up in a Roman Catholic country that was probably concerned about the encroachment of Islam to its south. That has been a major source of tension within Yugoslavia throughout its history.
Well, at that time, not particularly.
Because there was no Yugoslavia then.
Yeah, right. In the Kingdom of Yugoslavia from 1918 to 1941, most of the ethnic groups were living in peace, and Bartol was quite a Yugoslav proponent of the unity of all of those different ethnic groups within Yugoslavia, including the Bosnians. There was a great deal of sense of commonality in the country. So that wasn't so much the issue. It came mostly from a recommendation that was given to him in 1927 when he was a student at the Sorbonne by a fellow Slovene who was also a student there. There were a number of Slovenes studying at the Sorbonne back then. And this fellow student said, I have the perfect subject matter for you. It comes from Marco Polo, It's the episode in his travels where he writes about the old man of the mountain who deludes young men into believing he has the power of life and death and entrance into the afterlife, into paradise. And he gets them to carry out missions on his behalf and at the cost of their own lives. So that was the beginning of it, and he saw this from an aesthetic point of view. He liked this subject matter in its own right. He didn't really see it as a political allegory at that time of Europe, but it did grow into that with time. So his main character there, Hassan, began almost organically to represent what Bartol thought was the main new thing that the 20th century had brought to the world, and that was the phenomenon of the dictator.
Because Mussolini had come to power in neighboring Italy years before. Some people have seen a link between Hassan and Mussolini.
Yes, in fact, Bartol tried to dedicate the novel to Mussolini, actually to a certain dictator, just before it was published, but the editor persuaded him to leave that out.
And do you think that was a sincere dedication? It's been suggested that it might have been a kind of a mocking dedication.
Oh, it was. It was definitely a mocking dedication. Bartol didn't have, he had respect for the dictators as efficient people, I mean, smart people who knew how to accomplish their goals. But I'm positive he didn't have any compassion for them.
My guests are Michael Biggins, translator of Vladimir Bartol's Alamut, and also Chaza Koprovich, who is an editor at Sanya House, which publishes the book in Slovenia, actually is in partnership with North Atlantic Books in the translation of the book for the English language edition. What kind of reaction, Chaza, did Alamut get upon its publication? First of all, was Bartol already a famous writer at the time?
No, I should say no. Well, could I add something?
Of course.
I think that the core of Alamut does not focus on political ideology. Its nucleus is abundant with testimonies of intimate human values. Of course, Alamut can be seen as an unexplored literary manner, a novelty that had yet to gain the right to exist. A referendum of readers yielded the best possible results, I'm sure. Now, I believe that Bartol portrayed occurrences of his own time. His comparison, or better yet, allegory, depicted historical phenomena that proved to be typical of his own time. He once said that the imaginative faculty of an artist is always concrete, and its character's substance can therefore result only from contemporaries. At the same time, this first-class work of literature proves to be an everlasting written record of a genius, a visionary, a sensitive artist, and a man of science, who in his time wasn't seen as such. And, well, when we published the book in 2001, I believe, no, he wasn't a famous writer among Slovenes, not at all.
But the book had been a success in the late 30s.
A huge success.
What happened to him after its publication? Did he fight in the war?
He moved to Ljubljana. He was in Kamnik at the time, which came under Nazi occupation. And soon after that, he learned that the Nazis had plans for intellectuals, Slovene intellectuals. They were planning to incorporate that part of Slovenia into the Reich eventually, and there was no place for Slovenian intellectuals. So he left there quickly, went to Ljubljana, which was under Italian occupation. And he was very depressed at first, but within a few days or weeks, he met a friend who drew him into the underground, into the resistance. And he functioned there for the rest of the war. He felt it wasn't it wouldn't have been appropriate for him to do anything but that. So he gave up writing essentially for the duration of the war and wrote propaganda, bulletins, newsletters for the resistance.
Now, the English edition's blurb relates the story of Alamut to today's jihad warriors, and it is about a holy war, but doesn't the premise of the novel have more to do with the sensibility of the Arabian Nights than Osama bin Laden?
It's the Arabian Nights figure there very strongly. Bartol writes that he had about 100 books arrayed around him, most having to do with the history of the Middle East and also literature, medieval Persian literature, while he wrote the book. And he read and reread these things. And, of course, he wanted the 1001 Nights to be an element there. So, yes, this is like a 1002nd night.
Chaucer, what do you make of the of Hassan's slogan, "Nothing is true, everything is permitted"?
Well,
do you know where he got that from? He didn't invent that, did he? Michael, do you know?
Yes. There is, well, some people said, oh, you took that from Nietzsche, and he said, nonsense.
Yeah.
It's from a predecessor of Hassan, an Islamic or an Ismaili Shia sectarian leader in Cairo who promulgated that saying sometime in the century just before Hassan, in the middle of the 11th century. So he was adamant about the novel hewing closely to historical fact, at least historical fact, as European historians had represented it up until then. He was very widely read in the history, and he tried to keep it based on the history of the time and exclude anachronisms.
I want to ask about the history. Do you think that World War II played a role in the fact that it was a big success and then kind of disappeared for a while?
I think it played a huge role. I think the war changed Bartol's life. He actually planned to write two more volumes. He meant for this to be a trilogy. And when you read the book and you get to the end, you have a sense that it's not quite over. The young man who is the subject of sort of the Bildungsroman that this is comes out at the end embarking on his path into the world. And you sort of see him, the back of him, as he recedes into the distance. And there were two more volumes that were going to be that Bartol planned to write. In fact, he was going to take a trip to the Middle East in 1939 to get a sense of the region before he wrote them. But with war pressing down, he saw that coming. He thought that no Slovene patriot should leave his homeland and be caught away from it.
Is there an easy transition between Slovenian to English?
In what way?
Is this an easy language to translate into English?
Oh, well, as an Indo-European language, there are lots of commonalities. So we have that advantage. Bartol's style is very limpid. He did not try to ornament his prose at all. And he writes in simple, not too many compound sentences, but fairly straightforward sentences. There is nothing superfluous in the novel. Every detail, as a translator, you develop an appreciation for this, and you don't have much patience with prose that has superfluous things in it, and I found very little that was superfluous here. Everything seemed to be intentional and building to the entire effect, to the whole effect.
We have very little time left, but Chaucer, do you think it's because of that, the fact that this book is such a fun read, that it has been so popular in Slovenia?
I suppose so. It is also an impartial account of a historical truth, an account of a horrible epoch of humankind, which reads as a never-ending story. So, yes, it might be intriguing because of this particular fact, as well. I need to pose a question. Can a writer foresee concrete events? And then if I would try to give an answer to the question, I would say in the absence of mysticism, with a devotion of a man of erudition, intuitiveness, we might answer in the affirmative.
We have to leave it there, unfortunately, with that question. Alamut is published by Scholar House Press in partnership with North Atlantic Books. My great thanks to Michael Biggins, its translator, and Chasa Karpovich, who is an editor at Sanya House. Thank you so much.